Hey guys, the following podcast is a Lady Gang Network and Podcast One production, which means it's going to be awesome. All right, we are back with another episode of The Stacks. It's Monday today, which means it's the Short Stacks, our shorter conversations with authors about their process and their books. Today, I'm joined by Damon Young, and we're going to talk about his new book, What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker. I heard from some of you who have been listening to The Stacks via Android, and you may have noticed that the show is no longer available on some of your favorite streaming sites like Stitcher. But don't worry, you can still get the show at places like Spotify, the Podcast One app, Overcast, and more. So just do a little Googling, see what you find, but I promise we're still out there. You can still hear The Stacks. If you want more of The Stacks, head over to patreon.com/thestacks. Be a part of our virtual book club, get the inside scoop on the show, and more. To join The Stacks pack, go to patreon.com/thestacks. We have a segment on The Stacks where you can get book recommendations designed just for you from me and our guests. It's called Ask The Stacks, and it's great fun. All you have to do is email us at askingthestacks@gmail.com with your name, what you're looking for in your next read, and maybe a few things that you like or don't like in a book. Then you tune in. So send us your email at askingthestacks@gmail.com. If you're into audiobooks, you should definitely check out Audible. Audible is a site that has hundreds and thousands of audiobooks for you to listen to. And listeners of this show get a free audiobook download and a free 30-day trial by going to audibletrial.com/thestacks. If you like what you hear, please take a moment to rate and review this show wherever you listen to your podcasts, especially if you're listening to us through Apple Podcasts. All right. Our guest today is Damon Young. Damon is an author, the co-founder of Very Smart Brothers, a senior editor at The Root, and a columnist at GQ. Today, we talk about his new book, What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker, a memoir and essays. Everything we talk about can be found today in the show notes, and have no fear, no spoilers. All right, let's talk to Damon. All right, Damon, go ahead in about 30 seconds or less. Tell us a little bit about your book.
Okay, the book, What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker, is a dive into some of the angst, absurdities, and just anxieties of existing while black.
Ooh, that was like 7 seconds. That was really good.
You know what? I have it down to a science. I've been asked. This isn't my first rodeo. So
this isn't the first podcast you've ever been on.
I have, I have my elevator speech down.
Okay. Well, we'll dive in a little bit deeper, but we won't spoil anything. Not that you can really spoil a memoir. Mm-hmm. But let me ask you this. So your book is called What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker, and it's a memoir in essays, which is very cool. I really like that. But here's a question. How did you decide to do that instead of just going straight essays or straight memoir?
The idea actually came from my agent, Tanya McKinnon, who when we were connected to each other by a mutual Facebook friend, you know, she asked me if I had any ideas for a book. And I did. And my original idea was to have a book that would be very similar in structure and tone and content to Very Smart Brothers, to my blog, where, you know, if you've read VSB, where, you know, I'm known for these really quick, aggressive, punchy, snarky, voicey blogs about pop culture, race, politics, being a dad, being a husband, you know, whatever, food, chicken wings. And so the plan was for the book to kind of extend on that to, like, okay, this is a chapter about the rules of spades. This is a chapter about white privilege. Mm-hmm. And instead of writing, you know, I usually write like 600 to 1,000 words of VSB. These would be like 3,000 to 5,000 words.
Okay.
You know, chapters where I dive in and I, you know, maybe I interview people and I do some, even a little bit of research, and I do no research. and so that was the idea. That was the original idea. And she was like, you know, that that's a good idea, but I think I have something better. Mm-hmm. I think you should write a memoir and tell a story with some connectivity, with a narrative that people can relate to, that people will be able to feel. And you can insert those cultural observations and that humor and those critiques or whatever in the memoir. And I knew it was the right idea, but I'm like really stubborn. So It took me about a week to agree, even though I immediately, I was like, holy shit, that's a much better idea than the idea I had. But it took me a week to actually admit it. And so, yeah, that's why we decided to do that.
And did it free you up at all in your writing? Like, since it's a little bit different than what you do, did you find new stuff?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, and this, it's much more vulnerable, much more transparent than the things I tend to write about on the internet. Much more personal. And I actually surprised myself with some of the things, some of the places I went, and some of the topics I touched on. And these are, again, the sort of like vulnerabilities and self-consciousnesses that when I'm writing on the internet, I just don't really cover, because right. I don't have the space to, and I don't really have the need to.
Right. That makes sense. I feel like, so in the beginning of your book, you kind of mention those, the insecurities or the vulnerability or kind of being nervous about this book existing in the world. And I guess I wanted to know, like, how did you approach talking to the people in your life that you were going to talk about in the book? And when the book came out, like, did you give them a copy, or were you just like, hey, you're in the book? Or how do you navigate, like, obviously, you know, your dad or your wife, I'm sure they've read it, but you know, you talk about your basketball friends on Thursdays, mm-hmm. and like you talk about the PhDs, and you talk about these people in your life, and some very complimentary, and then also some kind of like, ooh, I wonder if that was me, how I would feel about that being said. So how did you kind of navigate that?
Well, with the people that I talk about and that I'm still connected to, I did let them see it before it went to, before I published. Some actually, like Tracy, who I write about in the, I think the third chapter, Bomb Ass Poetry, we're still Facebook friends. Okay. So I let her see the chapter. Jessica, who was an ex-girlfriend, mm-hmm. One of the PhDs, we're still friends too. And so I let her see the chapter that really, you know, talks about that relationship that we had, and also had some really like silly sex stuff in it, and she was fine with it. And the biggest I won't say problem, but like biggest anxiety, mm-hmm. was my dad and my wife, mm-hmm. Particularly my dad, mm-hmm. Because you know I feel like my, you know, the book is very it's very lauding of him. It shows his humanity. It, you know, it's, right. I feel like it's a, I believe that it, that accurately tells a story of him in the proper light, but there are some unflattering things. Mm-hmm. And it's also, you know, I talk about my mom's death, and that's still a very, very difficult subject for my dad.
Yeah.
And so that was the most difficult, but he was just like, you know, just tell your truth. Write the truth, tell your story. I support you. I love you. So that was definitely like a load off my shoulders hearing that from him.
Yeah. How about the book actually being in the world? Do you feel like people look at you different, or like, are you feeling kind of weirdly vulnerable, like this piece of me now exists without anything?
So it's funny. Like, I feel it like in theory. Like I, because yeah, it's out there now. This right. book with these things in it that are some of the things I didn't admit to, like my wife, my closest friends, my dad, and now there's going to be fucking book clubs.
Right. Like total strangers.
Yeah. Total strangers are going to know, you know, these things that I didn't tell anyone. That is pretty, just thinking about that. It's pretty, I don't know. It's pretty harrowing, right. actually. But when I talk to people about the book, I don't feel that anxiety. Hmm. Like when people who have read the book, when I actually talk to them about it, I don't feel I don't feel how I expect it to feel.
Interesting.
So I'm more anxious thinking about the big picture. But when I actually interact with people who have read it, that anxiety about that isn't there.
Interesting. So one of the things that I thought was really smart about your book the way that you approached kind of telling your story, you say very early on that you're not so much talking about the what, but you're talking about the why. Mm-hmm. So like these things that have happened to you, and you're talking about a lot of really big, complex societal issues like education and how we approach that and, you know, homosexuality and homophobia and just like a lot of things that are complex and have a lot of moving pieces to it. And I just really appreciated you coming from the why, because I feel like so much memoir can be the what, like explaining, then I walked to the store, then I opened the door, then like, and it's like, well, can you get to the part where you killed the person? Because I kind of like, that's what I'm interested in. And I want to know why you did it, you know? And so I felt like what happened is that you were able to like distill down much bigger things in a personal way because you were focused so intently on your own why. Was that process easy to come to, or did that help you to talk about the bigger things that maybe are scary?
Well, the why is the why was the central question,
right?
You know, when I started, even before I started writing the book, that why has always existed. And the what, you know, I'm not Michelle Obama. Like, people don't care about, like, what, like, oh, this is the year you graduated from high school, and this is, like, no one cares about my biography.
Right.
Like,
right.
And so focusing on a what was not, like, ever a consideration, because I know no one gives a shit about, about the what's in my life. You know, a few people, maybe, like, seven people. And so those whys, and those are the things that, even if everyone has different what's, and everyone does,
right,
has different what's, the whys, like the getting all the way down to like the meat, the bone, the gristle of like, okay, this is why this is happening. This is why I thought that. This is why I decided to do this thing. That's where the that's where that connectivity is, and where people are able to feel and like sit with the thing that you wrote. And so the why was cathartic, because as I was writing the book, I was also discovering things. And it also, you know, if you want to extrapolate, just had a greater purpose, because again, that's how people are able to connect.
Right.
And when people are connecting, that's, you know, that makes the book, I don't know, better.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, no, totally. So you write an apology for an article that you'd written in 2012 that became like a whole, you know, internet phenomenon. And that part of the, I mean, I thought that part of the book was fantastic. I was very wrapped in that chapter. But my question is more so, what do you think about the public apology, and what do you think makes a good one?
And so that chapter was the hardest one for me to write.
Interesting.
Because I wanted to make sure I got it right, because it's such a delicate, sensitive, and important topic. I'm a straight man writing about that, and also I fucked up.
Right.
And so how do I acknowledge this fuck up, put it in the right context, and also, I don't know, just use the right language and also be as transparent and as honest as I can possibly be about, I guess, the transition from, you know, from early 2012 to what, 2019.
Right.
And so the public apology. And in that piece, so just for context, in 2012, I wrote a really terrible, awful, I can't even think of more words to describe how bad it was. Piece about that was response to a woman's column or essay about sexual assault. And it was like very victim blamey. It was constructed badly. The premise was terrible. Everything about it was just bad, 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 bad. And so immediately I get, you know, people read it and like, what the fuck?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is terrible. What do you, this is like the worst thing I've ever read on this. Like, what's wrong with you? And not just terrible. This is hurtful. This is hurtful in a violent way.
Right.
Like in a whip, like people come to the site expecting to read like these really tongue in cheek takes on whatever. And you read this thing and it's just, you know, it was an act of violence.
Right.
So my initial response tutor response was incredulousness.
Mm.
Because I then believed that, you know what, my point was valid, but I just didn't express it the right way.
Right.
Or maybe people didn't, you know, were too sensitive, or perhaps like, you know, my history or, you know, what I've done up to that point should, you know, give me some leeway.
Right.
And so the chapter, you know, really just digs into like what was in my head mm-hmm. then and the way of thinking, and also talks about just this public apology, which you see very often when a celebrity or someone else who's in the news does something or says something terrible and then apologizes. An apology is always bad.
Oh, it's always bad.
It's always bad.
I'm shocked.
Yeah. And the reason, well, at least this is my theory, for the reason why these apologies are always bad is because they're not sorry yet.
That makes sense.
Because if you did this fucked up thing on a Monday
mm-hmm.
and you're apologizing on a Tuesday,
mm-hmm.
whatever compelled you to do that fucked up thing on Monday, that's still inside of you. Now
right.
you just know that you hurt people.
Right.
And now you know that you're supposed to apologize.
Right.
But there might still be something in you that believes that you were right.
Right. That you're apologizing for the people.
Yeah.
Which is why people say, I'm sorry if I offended you.
Sorry if I offended.
I'm sorry if I offended is honestly just, that's the worst. Don't apologize. It's like you did offend and you know it. Goodbye. Mm-hmm.
And so what needs to happen, you know, when a person does a thing like that, you know, that just a terrible thing that hurts people, is you need to go away.
Mm.
You need to say I fucked up. You need to listen to people. You need to be completely contrite.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to interrogate your intent, your thoughts, your actions, you know, your relationships
mm.
to figure out, okay, what was inside of me that caused me to do this?
Right.
And you know, ultimately, you just want to get to a place where you don't want to cause harm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened with me, where it's like, I don't want to be a person, I don't want to have a platform that causes people, particularly Black women, harm.
Right.
And so whatever I need to do to get there, I'm willing to do it, because I don't want to be this sort of person. I don't want to be thought of as this sort of person. I don't want to have this sort of effect on people. I don't want to hurt people. So you just, again, if you're sincere,
mm-hmm.
you do whatever you need to do to get to that point.
Yeah.
And yeah, and part of that realization, you know, and getting there was realizing, I guess, the fallacy of the good dude.
Sure.
Which again, I talk about a bit in that chapter, where, to be a good dude, you know, and I'm saying this with quotes,
yeah.
quotations, good dude, it means that you keep yourself safe.
Right.
That you have this inexhaustible alibi where, oh, Damon would never do this terrible, awful thing, 'cause he's good.
Right.
He's a good guy.
Right.
But being good is just like, it's inert. Like you're
right.
not. You're just there. You're not doing anything, you know, and what, I don't know, better, what's better than being good is being worthy.
Sure.
And being worthy of the friendships, worthy of support, worthy of the love, worthy of the fandom.
Mm-hmm.
And to be worthy, you have to work at that.
Right. Right. It's not something that just happens. So we talked a little bit about the what. We talked about the why. And I do want to talk about the how, like how a book comes together, how you wrote the book. So I guess let's start there. Where did you do your writing and how did you make time for it? Because you have a plethora of other places that you write. So how did you make it happen?
All right. So I have a great wife
mm-hmm.
who, you know, relationships have ebbs and flows.
Right.
And, you know, after I signed the book deal, household management duties, which were split, I won't say evenly.
Right.
But, you know, they were split more evenly.
Okay.
But she actually took up more of the slack.
Got it.
And that allowed me to, like, just really focus on getting the book done, getting my work done. And so what my days would look like is that I would do VSB stuff or GQ stuff or whatever internet stuff I was doing from, let's say, like 10 a.m. to about 5 p.m.
Okay.
And then, you know, I go play basketball. I, you know, say hi to my wife and kids. Like, hello, I'm here. I just want to let you know I'm still here. And do whatever. And then from 9 or 10 o'clock to about 2 or 3 in the morning,
wow,
I was doing book stuff.
Wow. So you can write all hours of the day.
Yeah. And so I was, that was like a 12, 13, 14 hour day. And that was for the whole first draft of the book. That was me. So that was like a six month process. Every weekday I was doing that. And for the book stuff, I actually would go to the Ace Hotel in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
And, you know, and it was great because they never closed. So you could just sit there and you could also order food. So I would sit, I would eat, I would write, all this stuff happening, but it was white noise to me. So I know that some people like go on leaves or, you know, some sort of retreat or whatever when they write their books. But I didn't do that.
You had a self-made writing fellowship at the Ace Hotel.
Yeah.
That's a perfect segue to my absolute favorite question, which is, do you have any favorite writing snacks or beverages?
Oh, writing beverage would either be a Godfather.
What's that?
That is scotch and amaretto.
Okay.
Or honey, Jack, and ginger ale.
Okay. So you can drink alcohol and write.
Yeah.
Got it. Yeah. Okay.
And drink, and you know, I am a pretty severe introvert.
Okay.
Even when writing sometimes.
Okay.
And so I don't drink to get drunk, but sometimes it loosens me up.
A little lubricant.
And it releases some inhibitions. And so with the Godfather, I would eat a burger. I would be like the cliche writer eating a steak and drinking a whiskey or while writing, you know, my memoir.
Oh my gosh. That's amazing.
At the bar.
Yes.
Yeah. I was such a cliche.
That's beautiful. Everyone always tells me coffee. So this is way better. I don't drink coffee either.
I'm not a coffee drinker.
Do you drink any warm beverage, morning beverage?
No.
No, no tea.
I'll drink a tea every once in a while, but there's no warm beverage. That's like a part of our regular routine.
Okay. Got it. So while you're writing and working, what are you consuming as far as other books, other writing, maybe movies, music? Like, what sort of stuff is fueling your life at this time, if you remember?
I'm reading a lot of internet stuff.
Okay.
You know, because that's just a function of not just my job, but just what I enjoy doing.
Okay.
You know, reading articles at, you know, Slate and The Atlantic and The New Yorker and, you know, and also The Root and Jezebel, Deadspin. So that, you know, was a big source of inspiration. I honestly, I kick myself for not doing this, but I didn't read any books while I was writing mine.
Okay.
And I know that that's a thing that some writers do, and it's a bad thing. because, you know, you do it because you don't want someone else's words to somehow worm their way inside of your head,
right?
And have some sort of impact on the things that you write. But it's impossible to prevent that from happening because you're consuming culture anyway. It's not like you're just going to be the Unabomber and in some cabin in the middle of the woods. I mean, you're still consuming things. You're still talking to people. So yeah, there are things that happen that you witness, that you consume, that are going to have an effect on your work. And so the idea, you know, well, I don't write any books, I'm writing my own. It's a bad idea. Like it's a thing I definitely did, but it's definitely not a thing to do.
Well,
like,
on your
when
next
I write the next book, I'm going to continue to read other books while I'm writing my book.
And what books do you read or do you like? Or like, what are some books that you've read, not during that time, but like recently, that you've been like, yo, that was dope, or like, highly recommend? Or maybe like a good, if someone liked your book, what are other things maybe in that vein that you would say they might like?
Okay, so those are two separate questions.
They're two different questions, but I put them together.
Well, if you like my book, I think you would love like Samantha Irby's, you know, We're Never Meeting in Real Life, or Meaty. With, you know, similar sorts of humor.
Okay.
And humor about sometimes very heavy and uncomfortable and even gross topics.
Okay.
So there's a lot of that. Now, as far as books that I've read recently that that I've really enjoyed, I mean, Kiese's Heavy, which is an amazing book.
Amazing.
So there's that. There's a book that I'm in, which is kind of cheating. it was edited by Kiba Solomon and Kiara Rankin. It's How to Fight White Supremacy.
Okay. That is it. It just came out.
Yeah. And that book has so much. It's basically an almanac.
Yeah. I haven't read it yet.
So many people that have contributed. Like I've made it like halfway through and it's one of those books that is like so rich because there's so much in it and so many different types of content.
Right.
Too, that are in it. So that was fun to write, you know, that portion. It was fun to read. I'm working my way through American Spy, Lauren Wilkerson, which is a great book. Nafisa's book, I'm working my way through that. Mm. So I haven't read Morgan Apple's book, who I was just on a podcast with. Or just on the panel with, but I'm going to when I get back home.
Yeah, that just came out too.
Yeah.
What is it? The Magical Negro, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny because, again, I went through the whole process of writing without reading. Mm-hmm. So I have all these books at home that, you know, were sent to me by like publishers and that I bought myself. And so I'm like looking forward to getting back home and like actually not being a dickhead anymore and reading.
And not having being so focused on like the what you're writing.
Yeah.
So I guess this is kind of a weird question, but I am interested in, it's not weird. It's actually, I think it's a great question.
I like weird questions.
I think it's great. So you're a Black American man. You wrote a book called What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker. Uh-huh. And then you shop the book around and it ends up, you know, at Echo, which is a major publisher, like part of HarperCollins. Mm. And I know that your editor is a white person. So like, how do you navigate that relationship? Like telling your story through the lens of someone who you're working with, who has a totally different thing and knowing that it's being marketed by like this huge, you know, company that's pretty white. I mean, publishing is, and that's not a knock on Harper necessarily at all. It's just more like, how do you navigate telling this story through those lenses?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, and you know, on the panel I was on yesterday at the LA Times Festival, we spoke on that about, you know, each of us, you know, on the panel is Morgan Parker, Safisa, it's myself and Rebecca Carroll, who, you know, is also writing a memoir. You know, Black people, Black Americans trying to write this work that centers Black people, that is very intentionally Black and transparent and honest and vulnerable and you know, and very intentional about the language and the characters and whatever, but doing it while, you know, in a predominantly white industry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, yeah, I have a white editor and she was great. She is great. I have a white publishing company.
Mm-hmm.
And so are you really subverting the white gaze
if
the gatekeepers are still white? And I think the answer to that question is that your work needs to have integrity.
Mm-hmm.
And also I think that as a professional, you know when your work is being compromised.
Right.
You know when an editor maybe just doesn't have the right sensibility and you just don't care because you want to get the book out there.
Right.
And so you have to be able to look yourself in the mirror.
Right.
And say that, you know what, I know that my book exists in this predominantly white world, but this book is still as true to me as it can possibly be.
Right.
And that could be a difficult thing to do because, you know, how do you know? How do you know that the white gaze hasn't had some sort of influence subconsciously on what you decided to write about and maybe the way you constructed your chapters and maybe language you used or language you didn't use.
Are those conversations that you have, like your editor comes to you and they say, you know, Damon, I think that you should, this doesn't work. And then you say, oh, maybe you're missing this reference because it definitely works kind of thing. Like, are those conversations that are had?
Well, you know, with my editor, the conversations weren't necessarily about references. Uh-huh. They were more about construction.
Okay.
And actually, my editor, both my editor and my agent was really good with this too, because I bounce stuff off of her all the time, wanted me to go deeper.
Okay.
And farther. So I had an editor, have an editor who pushed me.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, you made this reference, but what about you?
Okay.
You know, what about why? Again, dig into those whys.
Mm-hmm.
And the references are, those are the things that give the book some color, I believe, and give it, I don't know, that distinguish it and give it like a certain level of authenticity.
Right.
But the most important stuff is that digging into the meat of your why, the gristle of the why. And my editor did that. So even if she didn't immediately know all the references that I would make, or all the language or the jokes or whatever, she trusted me and I trusted her.
That's great. That's great. Okay. So I basically have just, I think, two more questions. One of which is, your book has the best blurbs, the most exciting people to me blurbed your book. And I basically want to know how you got them, if you got them or if some of it comes from your publisher. And also, can you just briefly talk about the Anti-Racist Book Festival, because Ibram Kendi is my idol. So those are two unrelated but related questions, because he blurbed you and I basically, like, I flipped your book over when it came and I was like, oh my God, I'm dead. I love all these people.
So I did a podcast with KSA Layman,
mm-hmm.
and it hasn't aired yet. It's going to air. It was for WNYC's Deaf Sex and Money. And it was about 30, 40 minutes long. We just had just a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I revealed to him was that when I approached him, and this was before the book, he blurred my proposal too.
Oh, okay.
And when I approached him, I felt like I was almost asking someone to the prom.
Oh.
Like, I was so nervous.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't, and we had never, at that point, and this is going back to 2016, we had never, like, interacted.
Okay.
So I didn't even know if he knew who I was.
Okay.
So I come and I'm like, yeah, you know, name is Damon Young. And, you know, if you don't have a date to the prom, I would hope you would come with me. And and I told him that story and he was like, dog, man, I've been a fan of yours, man. And so I had this trepidation about reaching out to KSA, reaching out to Dr. Kendi, reaching out to Brittany, Rebecca Traister. I mean, even though, you know, yes, I'm sure these people are familiar with my work, but still reaching out to people and asking them to write these, that's hard. Like, yeah. that to me is still the hardest part of the book process, is having to reach out to people and ask them to do you favors.
Right.
And if they enjoy the book, then you know, of course, I'll do it.
Mm.
But doing that and just hitting people up on, like, Instagram and Twitter and all of that, oh my God. Like, I had more anxiety about doing that than writing about masturbation.
I love it. Well, you got amazing blurbs, so you paid off. So then my last one question for you is, who's the coolest person so far that you've heard from who's expressed interest in your book, or who, like, liked your book and was like, yo, I read your shit and that was so great. Like, have you had any?
Coolest person? My dad.
Okay. All right.
My dad, you know, who really enjoyed it. You know, as far as, like, people that are, like, known,
mm-hmm.
Let me think. I've had the blurbs.
Okay.
And there were other blurbs that other people who gave the book lots that just, you know, either didn't turn the blurbs in time or just didn't make the cover. Like, Samantha Irby is another one. I have had really good reviews, and that, you know, that was an anxiety of mine, because not only is this book this, like, super vulnerable and transparent thing, but it's also like, okay, I'm writing a book now. It's a thing to be judged, and people are going to read this and judge it and critique it and like critique me.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that like NPR, Washington Post, you know, all the like the book list, Publishers Weekly, all of that, you know, gave it like really, really great reviews. That's not supposed to mean. I mean, you say that that's not supposed to matter.
Right.
You're supposed to say that, like, you know, you're supposed to just write your book and not give a fuck about how, like, the
right.
whatever but. Feels about it. But I did care.
Good.
I do care. That was an anxiety, and that's been, you know, pretty, I guess, alleviated at this point.
That's amazing. I lied and said that I had one last one, but I actually have one last one.
Okay.
Did you have any other titles for the book?
Oh, yes, definitely.
And can you tell us any of them?
The original title was actually Nigga Neurosis.
Okay.
Which, as I explain in the book, is a term to encapsulate the state of being where you're questioning whether a thing happened to you, good or bad.
Right.
Because you were black. You know, did I get the scholarship because I'm black? Did I not get the scholarship because I'm black? Is this person decided to sit next to me on the plane because I'm black, or are they going to the back? You could keep going
on
with it. And so that was the original title of the book. The proposal was sold with that title. My agent loved it. My editor loved it. People at HarperCollins loved it. And then my editor talked to her people at like Barnes & Noble and Amazon who were like, yeah, we love Damon. Can't wait for his book.
But
yeah, I don't know if we could have I don't know if we could carry a book with that title, but I don't know if we could have Nigga on 72 point font in the front of our stores. So maybe
they have the subtle art of not giving a fuck.
They do have the subtle art of not giving a fuck, but I don't like asterisks.
Okay.
So I wasn't going to asterisk.
But I mean, my point being that is asterisk is the most useless thing.
Yeah, I know.
Ever,
I know,
you know.
I know. And the thing is, I'm glad for that because this title is better.
It is.
You know, I love it so much that I end up putting it on my arm. It's a tattoo. I thought of the title while I was on a plane going to Essence Fest in July and working on some of the dialogue in one of the chapters. And what doesn't kill you makes you blacker just came to me. And then as soon as I got off the plane, I immediately Googled it just to, you know, because I assumed that
someone else
would have used that for like a Twitter handle or like some bullshit player or something.
right.
And then I saw like, oh, this, no one has used this. So called my agent, called my editor. We have a title now.
Amazing. I love that. Well, this is the end of our conversation, unless you have anything you want to add or say.
I want to thank you for inviting me on the show and also giving me a salad.
Oh, yeah. I fed him.
Beforehand, he gave me a salad. Some very tasty Trader Joe's crouton. So yes. I do
appreciate
that.
Shout out to Trader Joe's.
Yeah.
Well, you're welcome. And thank you for coming on the show. I'm so happy you're here. And everybody at home, make sure you go get yourself a copy of What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker by Damon Young. You can get it on IndieBound, Amazon, at your local bookstore, wherever you get your books. Check it out. And you narrate the audiobook.
I do.
So you could listen to Damon even more. All right, y'all. Thank you so much. Damon, thank you. And we will see you guys in the stacks. All right, that does it for us today on the Short Stacks. Thank you guys so much for listening, and thank you to Damon Young for coming on the show today. Get your copy of What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker wherever you get your books. A special thank you to the folks over at Echo Books for our copy. Remember, we're back on Wednesday for the Stacks Book Club with Kelty Knight to discuss Tiny Beautiful Things by Cheryl Strayed. To help support the Stacks and earn awesome perks, go to patreon.com/thestacks. Make sure you're subscribed to this show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, take a moment to rate and review the show. Go to audibletrial.com/thestacks for your free 30-day trial and free audiobook download. That's audibletrial.com/thestacks. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegeerigis. This episode of the Short Stacks was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.